It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The University's of Wisconsin Board of Regents is scheduled to vote today on a plan to increase tuition across all 13 UW campuses by 2%. Student fees would also increase under this proposal. For a decade, a tuition freeze kept in-state tuition for undergraduates flat. That freeze ended in 2023, and now universities are facing the pressures of inflation and rising costs. In just a bit, we'll hear from a Republican lawmaker who sent a letter to Regents yesterday urging them to vote against a tuition increase. But first, we have Julie Gordon, Vice President for Finance and Administration for the Universities of Wisconsin. Julie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Why does the UW system need this tuition increase?
Well, we think that this tuition increase of 2% is really a very measured response that allows us to maintain affordability, really maintaining our status as a leader in affordability in the Midwest, while also preserving the quality that I think our students and our Wisconsin families expect. I would say that our universities have done a lot of work in recent years to address structural deficits, to ensure that we're living within our means, that our expenditures are matching available resources. And this has involved, I think, a lot of hard work at our campuses in looking at every position and dollar spent. So, but, you know, I think at this point, inflation that's felt by Wisconsin families is our reality as well. And that definitely came into play in our recommendation to the Board of Regents. This proposal was below the rate of inflation for calendar year 25 when we started talking about and planning for the upcoming fiscal year 27. And now our proposal, we believe, is well below the current rate of inflation, which is really our best guess of what expenses will be and what we'll face in the year ahead. So we've worked closely with our universities to make sure we have a measured and balanced approach, really keeping our students, their educational needs, and Wisconsin as a whole in mind.
You say best guess. Last year, tuition increased by 5%. Is 2% enough to cover rising costs for the system?
Well, the 2% is going to be spent in really two primary ways. One is approximately half of it will be used to cover the salary increases for our faculty and staff. This is the general wage adjustment that the governor and the legislature approved for all state employees. But unlike the rest of state government, the universities of Wisconsin are required to fund about 30% of that state mandated salary increase. And that is typical to how we operate, and tuition is the way that we generally cover that cost to us, that cost increase, not only for the salaries, but also the fringe benefits that go along with that. I think we're also, as I said, seeing that inflation with utilities, fuel, technology, supplies. Really, the technology is a significant piece that I can't speak to enough. We're seeing increases in technology, 10 to 40% at the current time. So is 2% enough? I would say that we are recognizing where our Wisconsin families are and, again, trying to maintain that affordability. This is something that we are making work, trying to address the needs of Wisconsin and the basic needs of our universities.
You mentioned structural deficits, universities operating in the red. A number of UW campuses are facing these structural deficits. About half of the system's two-year campuses have closed or been phased out. In the system statement, it said this increase is meant to ensure long-term financial stability. Is a broader restructuring needed?
Well, I can't speak to that at this point. I think that would involve a lot of discussions with our Board of Regents and with our universities, with the state legislature and our communities. And so I can't speak to that, but I would say that structural deficits right now are not the issue that our universities are facing. As I said, the numbers that you cited were correct. In fiscal year 24, in fiscal year 25, we've done that hard work. We have reduced the number of positions. When you look at the number of positions that we have from since 2018, not including UW-Madison, we are down approximately 1,000 positions across the universities of Wisconsin as a whole. That is those tough decisions that I was talking about. When we look at state-funded positions specifically, we are down more than 1,200 positions since 1993. So we've made those tough decisions. We have right-sized our budget. We are always looking for efficiencies. That is not something that we will ever stop doing. But I think the proposal is a modest one before the regents today to help address the basic costs that, and increases that we are facing.
Julie, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Julie Gordon is Vice President for Finance and Administration for the Universities of Wisconsin. We've been talking about a UW Board of Regents vote later today that would increase undergraduate tuition by 2%. Now, Republicans at the state capitol have been critical of this tuition increase proposal, and we'll hear from one of those voices. We have Representative Dan Knodel of Germantown, who represents the 24th District in the southeastern part of the state. Representative Knodel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Yesterday, you sent a letter to UW Regents urging them to reject this tuition increase plan. Why is a 2% increase not justified?
Well, the 2% increase is following three earlier years of increases from 3.75 up to 5% on the previous increases. So this is simply a continuation of passing on additional tuition costs to our families of Wisconsin. And I just go back to UW's own mission statement when they announced that they are future ready for all. And the key in there is for all. And if college becomes less affordable every year, that future is going to be available to actually fewer Wisconsin families, because that affordability becomes more challenging.
You said the UW should instead focus on reducing costs rather than increasing tuition. Where should this cost cutting come from?
Well, I primarily have focused on the administrative bloat that we've seen. We've seen a loss of up to 16,000 students over the years. And but the administration hires have increased. So there, why would you need more administrators for less students? It just doesn't make sense. And it's not an efficient way to do business, whether you're in the private or the public sector.
Let's look at this tuition freeze that lasted a decade, first adopted under Republican Governor Scott Walker in 2013. Legislature renews that freeze four times under biennial budgets before returning authority to the regents at the conclusion of 2021 budget cycle. Regents then ultimately lifting that freeze in 2023. Would you support another tuition freeze? And if so, for how long?
Time to look at that. So I would consider supporting that because of these continued increases that we've seen over the last 4 years that the regents have approved. So it's the one way for the legislature to put some restraints on this type of situation, continued tuition increases. And then it forces the system to become more efficient. And often in government, that's about our only hammer, is to hold dollars, withhold dollars, or in this case, not allow tuition increases. And then you force the entity to become more efficient with the current dollars that they have.
So how long would you want a tuition freeze to last?
I don't know that I have a number of years in mind. I don't think it would be something to up to 10 years that we've seen in the past. To your earlier point mentioned to Julie, perhaps it's for a period of time where they need to do a broader restructuring. So you asked that question. It was not answered, but certainly that is what has to be considered here, is that we need to look at a broader restructuring of the entire UW system. And it all comes back to return on investment. If the state, through the legislature is going to allocate more dollars, which we have in this particular budget cycle, 250 plus million, and another 850 million for buildings. We want to see the return on that investment. And often in government, that is something that is not done. There is not an accountability at the end of the spend to see if there is a good return on the investment of taxpayer dollars.
So on the point of restructuring, do you mean because we have seen 8 of the 13 UW two-year branch campuses that have been closed or phased out, do you want more branch, you know, campuses to close? What do you mean by restructuring?
You have to, two things. Yes, you can certainly follow up on that if there's not a need for the amount of campuses that we do have. We've seen that at the two-year schools, and that really is just responding to demand. The demand was not there. We didn't have students signing up for those programs. So it makes sense to adjust and downsize or restructure that. And then, so that can be looked at. Then you have to look at the curriculum, the number of degrees that are out there and they're offering, and what, again, is the return on investment? Do we need all those different degree paths? Is the state of Wisconsin benefiting from the students that have graduated with these degrees? Are they being employed in the state of Wisconsin? Are they being productive in growing our economy? So those two areas, which would be the size of the system and then the offerings that they have.
Representative Knodel, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you on Wisconsin.
Dan Knodel is a Republican State Assembly lawmaker from Germantown representing the 24th District. We've been talking about a Universities of Wisconsin plan to raise tuition for undergraduate students by 2%, a vote coming today. We previously spoke with Julie Gordon, Vice President for Finance and Administration for the UW system. For disclosure, Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of UW-Madison, and WPR staff are employees of UW-Madison. Coming up, the State Department of Public Instruction kicks off an effort to make sure students come out of school with the skills they need. We check in on what it takes to be ready for higher education and the job market.
These are things like ability to communicate well. These are things like teamwork. These are things like how to cope with uncertainty and how to problem solve.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction is launching a new initiative called Portrait of a Graduate. It aims to define the types of skills and experience students need for success after high school. A DPI committee is surveying residents, holding public listening sessions, and meeting with education leaders. They want to determine a shared vision for what a properly prepared student looks like, whether they enter the workforce or go to college. With graduation approaching for high schools around the state, we're checking in on what colleges and employers are looking for from Wisconsin graduates. Mindy Thompson is a professor of counseling psychology and the director of the Center for Research on College Workforce Transitions at UW-Madison. She spoke with Rob Ferret.
How much has the landscape changed for students who are entering the workforce now compared to 10 or, I don't know, maybe even 5 years ago?
Well, I would say, you know, based on my own experience and our research at CCWT, as well as the students that we work with and interview, it has changed dramatically.
Is that, I mean, the story we keep hearing is it's artificial intelligence. How much of it is AI?
I think it's AI combined with a whole host of other factors. You know, coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, we really saw an increase in mental health concerns and distress among college students and even students in high school and earlier. And that has been one piece that has continued to increase in terms of students' distress levels. Part of that distress, when we talk to students, is related to not knowing what their future holds in terms of potential for financial stability in the future, potential for having a stable job, potential for having a family, having a place to live. So all of that in combination with now in more recent years, the AI landscape rapidly changing. And of course, there's a whole lot of messages that students are hearing about what this will mean for their futures.
Okay, with all of that uncertainty, all these question marks, and they're very real questions, are there things we could say, hey, these are skills or these are kinds of knowledge that you, that student entering the job market at whatever level, need to know or can work on preparing despite all that uncertainty?
Yeah, so we've known for a while that something that is commonly referred to as soft skills or transferable skills, that these are important for students for competencies to be successful and to enter into the workforce, whether that be a sort of internship or co-op or apprenticeship level or position or future in terms of their career. But these soft skills or career competencies also are defined by some national organizations. So these are things like ability to communicate well. These are things like teamwork. These are things like how to cope with uncertainty and how to problem solve.
Okay. My worry is I keep hearing about how people of all ages are using, say, a chatbot to write an email for them, to write a paper for them, to write their resume.
Yeah.
Are we losing the ability to learn those communication skills if we're outsourcing it to different kinds of AI?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that's one of the concerns that we increasingly are hearing. You know, it's interesting when you talk to students, students are hesitant about AI. So they sort of value some pieces of it, right? Like talking to a chatbot, having someone who edits their emails or even sometimes writes their emails for them. And they're also concerned because they know that they may not be learning the skills that they want to learn or need to learn. And they're also concerned, of course, about whether they're going to have jobs in the future if AI starts to do all of these things for us.
Now, I this is a constant question. This isn't a new thing. The idea of, hey, I know there's lots of jobs in this line of work, the local factory, computer programming, healthcare, whatever the case may be. And that can change over time. Factories close, AI or automation take over certain job functions that we didn't think they could in some ways. How much do we talk about, hey, you should be training for a specific line of work versus, hey, you should be broad-based and learning general skills that allow you to be versatile in a potentially changing job market?
Yeah, I think this is maybe the fundamental question, right, of what we're doing with education at the moment is how do we still focus on teaching students those very specific skills that they would need to enter a particular job, and also knowing that those jobs are highly likely to shift and change over time, as well as their ability to get a job in a certain sector of the economy.
This is a complaint I hear sometimes from students at college and even in high school. Hey, I'm trying to be certified for a particular job. Why do I need to take these classes in English or whatever, social sciences or whatever, if that's not directly germane to my job? How can educators and educational institutions balance out and make the case that, hey, you need those specific skills. You also need some of this general stuff to hit those soft skills sweet spots.
Yeah, I think that's the piece around really thinking about career competencies. And if we're starting to prepare students to develop those career competencies and to have access to it, sometimes that includes learning from disciplines outside of your chosen career area to better understand a broad conceptual field in a way that helps you to learn and refine your own critical thinking skills. So critical thinking we know is essential to one of our competencies as we move forward and being successful in any job. And so that there's a way in which exposure and broad exposure, it allows students to be able to begin to develop those skills, to think about people and places and things from other perspectives, and really increases or has the potential to increase perspective taking.
You mentioned earlier getting that internship or other kinds of students on the job experience. Do you think there are enough opportunities out there? It seemed like, just thinking back to my high school and college experiences, it seemed like some of them were kind of few and far between.
Yeah, and actually that's getting worse, not better.
Oh, okay.
So there are definitely not enough of those work-based learning experiences that we know are really critical for students and their development out there. And actually what we're seeing is a decrease. If we look at college internship postings in particular, for example, we see that over the past 5 years, there have been a decrease in the numbers of employers that are posting those experiences and those opportunities for students, and an increase in the number of students who are applying to get those experiences.
Earlier, you mentioned mental health concerns for graduates these days, high school and college, I think we're talking about. How does dealing with that help a student develop that career success, as well as, of course, their mental and emotional well-being?
It's something that, as we think about understanding and knowing ourselves and having the capacity to, let's say, cope with distress or cope with changes or cope with conflict, that it's really critical that we have those capacities within ourselves, that we know where to go and to get the support to allow us to be able to perform our best in the moment in any sort of workplace situation.
Now, here we have this effort by the State Department of Education just announced to develop this portrait of a graduate. And they're trying to define, hey, what do kids coming out of high school in particular need to be ready for the job market? So say they come to you and say, Mindy Thompson, what would be at the top of your agenda for Wisconsin and preparing our students for the future? What would you tell them?
Yeah, I would tell them that I think we need to focus on finding that balance of the career competencies. We need to teach students and train students to be able to think critically, to be able to adapt to a rapidly changing environment, to show and be able to demonstrate professionalism in communication, in teamwork, in collaboration, and that all of those things require sort of that focus on teaching and training specific skills that are, of course, going to be essential in particular jobs, while also really attuning to the whole person and students' holistic beings as critical and essential to preparing them to be entering the workforce.
And Mindy, finally, as we wrap up, watching from my vantage point, I'm thinking, man, I'm glad I'm not a kid entering the job market now.
Yes.
It wasn't necessarily easy when I was that age. It looks a lot harder now. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah. I think this is what students are feeling, right? They're feeling this added pressure. They're getting all sorts of messages. Social media obviously looks really different than it did 10, 20 years ago in terms of the ways and spaces that students are getting messages in social media spaces that are sort of unfiltered, uncontrolled, and really, I think, increasing that sense of pressure and coupling that with the current state of the unpredictability of the labor market, it's a lot.
Mindy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Mindy Thompson is a professor of counseling psychology and director of the Center for Research on College Workforce Transitions at UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about the types of skills and knowledge students need as they enter the workforce. Now we're looking at what Wisconsin high school graduates need to know to be successful in college or other post-secondary education. Scott Ludostansky is managing director of Gallen Education, a Wisconsin-based tutoring service that helps high school students prepare for college. He's also executive director of State Street Education in Madison. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. For that high school student thinking about college now, maybe even sophomore, junior year, what kind of skills and knowledge are most important for them to develop as they get ready to apply for higher education?
Well, I would almost frame it as like there's sort of these two components. In fact, I even like to kind of latch onto the words of the content and the process, right? Part of school is there's always going to be a learning component to school. I think that's obvious. And in terms of the process, I think that's a lot of what we're seeing now with high school students as they're finishing up their last few years of high school is how can I really start to become more independent, manage more of my world, be able to keep track and communicate and problem solve in ways where I don't have to necessarily be walked through it. I am really gaining that autonomy from the parents, the friends, the teachers, the people in my life, you know, that helped me get through those things.
Well, that's interesting because as a parent who's been through this process, yeah, there's this fine line. Like, well, you want to make sure deadlines are met and your kids are applying to the colleges that they have a shot at getting into and things like that. And wanting them to do the work themselves so they learn how to do this. What is your advice for the parent in that situation?
So I actually was going to say, I think a lot of it falls on the parent, because as a parent, our instincts are jump in, help. And I think there's also this constant debate as a parent of letting my kid, I'm not going to say fail maybe, but like, you know, hit some speed bumps and come through it on their own versus, wait, no, a speed bump could mean they get a B or a C or a D or what, you know, whatever the scenario is. I'm giving a generic one. I think that's challenging. And so I think as parents even, and I have this conversation with parents, I think it's important to kind of, you mentioned sophomore, junior year, to kind of look across sophomore year, junior year, senior year, and really try to map out, how am I phasing myself out? What are all the areas I'm supporting my student? Maybe right now I'm sitting down with them and actually clicking through their, you know, course sites and their portal and their homework every night. But how do I start to scale that back over time? And as a parent, we just don't think that way because it's just so against our natural instincts. But putting that sort of long-term 2-3-year focus on it can really leave your kid in a great spot by the time they're getting ready to head off to college.
Now, I had asked Mindy what she would want to see from this portrait of a graduate effort from the State Department of Public Instruction when it came to workforce preparedness. If they came to you, Scott, and said, okay, we want to know what schools can do to prepare kids for college, what kind of things would you suggest to them?
If I simplify the work that we do with students, I simplify it down to 3 steps, which is number 1, do I know what I need to do? Number 2, can I plan, manage, and organize what I need to do? And number 3, can I do what I need to do? Now, we could deconstruct all 3 of those steps into a lot of different soft skills, a lot of executive functioning skills. You know, time management certainly is one that kind of jumps to my mind as such a key piece for high school and college students, especially making that transition. And so, you know, I'm a little biased, but I always think those executive function skills jump to mind. And certainly with that close link towards emotional regulation and emotional well-being. So I really would love to see high school students really able to execute those 3 steps and sort of have the toolbox where they're ready to be able to do that on their own.
I think back to my high school to college experience, and I was kind of a smart kid in high school. And when I went to college and I realized, oh, these are all smart kids and like smarter than me in many ways. And I hadn't really developed the work skills, I think, that I needed. And it took me, there was some learning curve there in college. What kind of things can we do to make sure kids are ready to do the kind of work, the kind of educational work that they need to do when they hit college?
Yeah, I mean, I call what you're referring to as high school mode. Mm-hmm. And we see a lot of students where they're very bright and they get stuck in high school mode, which is, I can make it work in high school. I can, you know, I have a test tomorrow. I'll just look at a few things tonight and it's all good. Or I have a paper due Monday. I'll just hit it, you know, 6 o'clock Sunday night. And that works in high school. I do think in college, the biggest piece that students struggle with in the sense of they're creating a new baseline for how they function. Like, what are all the things that I need to do in a given week in college to be successful that's different than high school? It is a step up. It is more difficult. What kind of jumps to the front of my mind is really how are they structuring their free time? And how are they, again, I'm going to go back to the word structure, but like creating structure and consistency out of those unstructured times. How are they able to manage the academic tasks that they have to do, such as, you know, note-taking, reviewing lecture slides, just purely studying, these tasks that aren't tied to points, deadlines, or submissions that they now have to do. And I think starting to learn and understanding those pieces and how they can, you know, manage their time around that is really important for college students to make that transition into, let's call it college mode to keep it simple.
I talked to Mindy a little bit about how AI, artificial intelligence, is changing the work world. You're working directly with students at your organization. What are you seeing their experiences with AI in the educational and college prep process?
Well, that could be a whole show to itself.
Definitely.
I'll keep it simple. I think it's an amazing tool when students use it as a strategy. If it's, hey, I need to read 2 chapters in a textbook. For a lot of students, that is long. It takes a lot of energy. They don't get a lot out of it. And so I think there are academic tasks where students are able to tap into AI tools that it can make them so much more efficient and help them learn. However, at the end of the day, the information still has to go into your brain. Like, you still have to make that happen and put that work in. But I do think there are such cool tools out there for students to use especially even students with learning disabilities, with dyslexia, with ADHD. Like, I think they're awesome tools to so quickly change the mode in which they're able to consume the information.
As we start to wrap up, Scott, speak directly to that high school student now who's thinking, maybe not sure, but thinking about headed for higher education. What should be at the top of their mind to, you know, do that work, to exercise their minds in school to be ready when they're applying and then heading to their freshman year?
Yeah, this is so, I think, a little out of the box. But I would tell them to really work on improving their ability to get started on work and their stamina. Because with the hundreds and hundreds of college students that we've worked with, what often ends up being the most detrimental to their mental health, to their ability to be productive and stay in school, is simply their ability to get started and stay focused on work. And there's a lot of components that go into that. But I think, you know, with the landscape, with technology, those students that are able to simply do that, I'm saying it like it's a simple thing, it is not a simple thing, but the students that are able to do that, I often find have easy success in college because they're able to work hard and get the coursework done.
Great advice, Scott. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That is Scott Lodustansky, Managing Director of Gallen Education. It's a Wisconsin-based tutoring service that helps high school students prepare for college. He spoke with Rob Ferret to share what skills and experience Wisconsin high school graduates need to be successful in college. And earlier, we heard from UW-Madison counseling psychology professor Mindy Thompson about how students can best prepare to transition into the workforce. What do you think a properly prepared high school graduate looks like? How did you decide to go to college or join the workforce? What is the young person in your life most concerned about as they make this transition into adulthood and get established? Send us an email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, two Milwaukee Art Museum exhibits highlight a circle of artists in Wisconsin and Chicago who shook up Midwestern art in the 1940s.
They love to get together. They love to party hard. They had a very funny way to present themselves to the world and not so serious about their status.
That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the 1940s, Wisconsin was home to a tight-knit community of artists who embraced magic realism, an artistic style that paired detailed, realistic paintings with surreal elements. At the center of this group of artists and friends was a Chicago painter named Gertrude Abercrombie. She hosted legendary literary salons at her home in Hyde Park with other artists and jazz greats. Now, a major traveling exhibit about Abercrombie's work is making its only Midwest stop at the Milwaukee Museum of Art. The exhibit, Gertrude Abercrombie, The Whole World is a Mystery, is on display in Milwaukee through July 19th. And Wisconsin artists are featured in a companion exhibit called Gertrude and Friends, the Wisconsin Magic Realists. Thomas Basiglio Ritter is an art historian and associate curator of American art at the Milwaukee Art Museum. He spoke with host Rob Ferret.
Before we get to the exhibit, I want to look at this concept of magical realism. It can mean different things if it's a novel or visual art or whatever. When it comes to the visual art that we're talking about and Wisconsin's artists of the 1940s, what do we mean by magic realism?
We mean a group of artists that was mostly based in Milwaukee and Madison that at the turn of the 1940s really tried to chart a new way for American painting by rejecting the idealistic style of regionalists like Grant Wood, for example, and really embracing the fantastical, the magical, the sort of dreamlike aspects of life. So they were still interested in their immediate surroundings in the Midwest, but they abstracted those objects and surroundings and coupled them in painting with sort of dreamlike, fantastic elements.
And then there's like surrealist painting coming from Europe from the decades before that. Is that an influence here? Is it something that was kind of slowly trickling into Midwestern art?
Surrealism was absolutely an influence, although I don't think magic realists were really fond of all those isms and titles affixed to them. I think surrealism had its own theoretical sort of backbone that was developed in Europe, and that was definitely different from that. This was sort of a grassroots movement. They didn't have a lot of manifestos or theories like that. They just came together and painted what they felt like painting.
Now, this wasn't like a full-fledged artistic movement, I guess, but it was this, if I'm reading it correctly, a community of like-minded artists who spent time together and with the Chicago-based painter Gertrude Abercrombie, who we'll get to in just a moment. Can you tell us a little bit about the artists in this sort of circle of friends making this new kind of art in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. It was definitely a community of support and like-minded people. The two sort of founding figures were John Wilde and Carl Preeby, both based in Milwaukee. And especially Preeby really impulsed that movement towards magic realists. They were joined by a number of sort of outsider artists like Marshall Glazer, who was still living with his parents in Madison and would host a lot of the groups at his parents' house in Madison. Dudley Hupler was another artist, Sylvia Fine, and then you're right, Gertrude Abercrombie, who was introduced to the group through her friendship with Carl Preeby and was pursuing the sort of same artistic motifs as the group.
What was the response like to their visions of Wisconsin and Midwestern life being so different than what we might have seen in Midwestern art before that?
They certainly got a lot of coverage and participated in a lot of exhibitions starting in the late 1930s. I think the zeitgeist of the time with the Great Depression and the Second World War made it really easy for their works to be received by the public. They were weird and cultivating that weirdness. And I think it resonated with troubled times as well. And it was something fresh and new that people were craving at the time.
As you look back at these artists, do you get a sense of their personalities? It seems like, from my limited exposure here, a kind of a zany bunch of people getting together to, make art, but also to hang out and have dinner parties and that kind of thing.
Totally. Quirky is the word I would use. And they cultivated that aspect. They love to get together. They love to party hard. They love jazz music and bebop music starting in the late 1940s. And they were trying to present themselves, whether through their public speeches or through their self-portraits, in a way that was very different from your sort of traditionally trained artists, the art school artists.
All right, let's walk into the museum now. And you've got a couple things going on related to this conversation. First, Gertrude Abercrombie, we mentioned, a Chicago artist who is close to this Wisconsin scene. And this is a national touring exhibit of The Whole World is a Mystery. Tell us a little bit about Gertrude Abercrombie, her influence and her connection with these Wisconsin artists we've been talking about.
She was a self-taught artist, active in Chicago for most of her life. Started not in art schools, but in commercial art. She worked for department stores like Sears Roebuck at first, and was really influenced by some encounters she made along her path, including sculptors and art critics that encouraged her to pursue a professional artistic career. She herself was born to opera singer parents. She toured the country and then lived in Germany with them as a toddler. So she was destined to have a life in the arts. And starting in the mid-1930s, she really started to chart her own course.
And now paint us a picture of the exhibit. What do we see when we visit?
So you'll start the exhibit by being face-to-face with Gertrude Abercrombie in large format and very small format, two self-portraits from the early 1940s. And the reason why we put these portraits face to face in the very first room you enter is to give you an idea of how playful the show will be and how important experimentation with scale and color and support was to Gertrude Abercrombie. She was anything but a conventional painter. And then the very first room that you experience is also devoted to what was her first inspiration, which was her childhood in Aledo, Illinois, a very small town on the border between Illinois and Iowa that was going to become her first source of inspiration in the 1930s.
There's this friendship she has with these Wisconsin artists. One painting that struck me, a group portrait, John Wild, one of the Wisconsin artists we mentioned, did a portrait of them all standing together, identified. We can identify them all by name. And then one unnamed person who is nude, weirdly. What's the story behind that painting?
That painting is a very funny and also affectionate background for us because it actually belonged to Gertrude Abercrombie. She bought it from John Wilde in the 1960s after he painted it. It was a way for them to reminisce on their time together 20 years or so earlier as a group. And in the main exhibition, the Gertrude Abercrombie retrospective, we actually have a really beautiful painting from 1940 called Letter from Carl. And that's her, in a way, response, or rather, I should say, the other way around, Wilde was the response to that, in which she is paying tribute to those Wisconsin artists that were her friends and supporters. So there's a very funny dialogue going there. And famously, that very small portrait that John Wilde painted, Gertrude wrote him a letter saying that she didn't even want to hang it, she would keep it on her lap and reminisce about their time together.
How did we land this touring exhibit in Milwaukee? As you mentioned, it's not showing in a lot of places, and I think this is the only Midwestern stop.
It is the only Midwestern stop, and it was a bet from the museum at first because many of her works are smaller scale, and our main exhibition space where that show was presented is 10,000 square feet. So it was definitely going to be a challenge, but I think that our director at the time, Marcel Poletnik, saw the potential for this show to be very relatable and tell a different story of Midwestern art and be fun and entertaining and at the same time deal with a lot of themes from, you know, identity to place. And so they decided to take a bet and take this show. And fortunately for us, no other venue in Chicago especially did want to take on this exhibition.
We're talking with Thomas Basiglio-Ritter, Associate Curator of American Art at the Milwaukee Art Museum. The museum is hosting a traveling exhibit about Chicago artist Gertrude Abercrombie and a companion exhibit called Gertrude and Friends, the Wisconsin Magic Realists. So yeah, part two of this opportunity, Thomas, was to have these Wisconsin artists on display. Tell us about this companion exhibit.
This is a show that we opened in December that is 3 months before the main retrospective opened. So at first, I really conceived that show as a sort of teaser to entice people to come back and start hearing about Gertrude Abercrombie. And now that the main retrospective is open in our main exhibition space on the ground floor, this small show has evolved into a sort of bonus show. So in a way, if you want to explore more about this Chicago artist and her link to Wisconsin and Milwaukee, especially, you can make your way into the permanent galleries and see that show.
Let's look at a couple of the pieces on display in that exhibit. There's one by Marshall Glazier. It's called John Stuart Curry and the University of Wisconsin Bull Breeding Machine. John Stuart Curry, an artist himself, did a more traditional, I think, style of displaying rural Wisconsin in the Midwest. What was going on in this painting?
This painting is one of my favorite and one of the funniest definitely in the show. It's really sort of indicative of the opinion that Glazier had of John Stuart Curry. Now, Curry was at the time the artist in residence at the College of Agriculture of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he had already had some success with his friend Grant Wood and with Thomas Hart Benton in establishing the sort of Midwestern style, if you want, this regionalist style. So he was tremendously influenced even when he reached the state, and then he kept training students at UW-Madison. And Glazier was just not convinced. He was saying things like, Curry is one of the most boring people I ever met. And he also criticized Curry for painting this sort of idyllic vision of the Midwest as this paradise of agriculture. So to him, it was as if Curry had sort of a blind spot and couldn't really see the Midwest, even if he observed it. So he might as well be painting dead meat.
I feel like I've talked about Curry's work before, and I feel like there are people in 2026 who might punch me in the mouth for saying that kind of stuff about his work. How was that kind of criticism of another and, you know, well-regarded artist received at the time?
Well, I mean, Glaser didn't have, of course, the influence that Curry had. But when Curry died in 1946, the interesting thing is that the artist who took over his position at UW-Madison was a man named Aaron Borod, whose work is also represented in the show. And Borod had a very different approach, more, you know, closer to Carl Priebe and Marshall Glaser, not so much classic regionalist. So, you know, just through time and in the late 1940s, it actually changed, and Curry's style kind of faded away.
Another painting here, Night Tryst by Carl Priebe, another take on magic realism. Tell us a little bit about that painting.
Night Tryst is one of the many birds-themed paintings that Priebe painted during his life. He had a fondness for birds, famously painted them at very different scales. This one in particular is a sort of icon for the way it shows the birds placed in this fantastical night setting with various objects just laying there. And this sort of clash of visuals was something Priebe loved to do, to sort of unsettle, interrogate, and force you as a visitor to see that bird in a different way. He continued doing that for many, many years. He was famously sketching animals and especially birds at the Milwaukee Zoo and taking his students there for decades. He was a professor at the Layton School of Art at the time. So this painting is, you know, has been in our collection for a while and is really sort of an icon of his type of art.
Turning back to the Gertrude Abercrombie traveling exhibit for a moment, you've described this as a non-traditional hanging in terms of the way that the exhibit is displayed. What do you mean? What does that look like?
Well, our exhibition designer, David Rusick, and I spoke at length about what we wanted the experience of going through the space to be. And we settled very early on the idea that we didn't want it to be a straight sort of gallery experience, like a very long hallway that you would just be able to traverse in one breath and see works on every side. We wanted the experience to be a sort of labyrinth, a sort of maze through the complex mind of Gertrude Abercrombie. She was a very rich persona. She was very creative, very imaginative, and so she was anything from straightforward. And so throughout the design and the hanging of the show, we are inviting people really to turn corners and face sort of dead ends sometimes and have to find their way through the various sections. Of course, we're guiding people. No one's going to actually get lost in the space. But the experience I like to liken it to is Alice in Wonderland, really turning a corner and suddenly being surprised by a work or a group of works that you couldn't see before.
Thomas, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Thomas Basiglio Ritter is Associate Curator of American Art at the Milwaukee Art Museum. He spoke with host Rob Ferret about Wisconsin's Magic Realists, a group of artists and friends who championed a more surrealist style of painting in the mid-20th century. The exhibit, Gertrude Abercrombie, The Whole World is a Mystery, is on display at the museum through July 19th, along with a companion exhibit called Gertrude and Friends, The Wisconsin Magic Realists. Next week, the author of a new memoir will share a deeply personal story of going through the adoption process in the late 1980s and 90s. We'll find out why he says the adoption process is like a roller coaster and how no two adoptions are ever quite the same. And we'd like to hear your story about adoption and the emotional journey that you went on. Did you navigate the adoption process recently or a long time ago? What was that like for your family? And how does it make you feel today? over the years what's been the relationship like between birth parents and adoptive parents. Share your story on adoption by emailing us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. The number either way is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa and Lauren Cox. Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.